This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents The Raven Boys, Book 1 of The Raven Cycle by Maggie Stiefvater, read by Will Patton. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. Edgar Allan Poe. A dreamer is one who can only find his way by moonlight, and his punishment is that he sees the dawn before the rest of the world. Oscar Wilde. Prologue. Blue Sargent had forgotten how many times she'd been told that she would kill her true love. Her family traded in predictions. These predictions tended, however, to run toward the non-specific. Things like, something terrible will happen to you today. It might involve the number 6. Or, money is coming. Open your hand for it. Or, you have a big decision and it will not make itself. The people who came to the little bright blue house at 300 Fox Way didn't mind the imprecise nature of their fortunes. It became a game, a challenge to realize the exact moment that the predictions came true. When a van carrying 6 people wheeled into a client's car 2 hours after his psychic reading, he could nod with a sense of accomplishment and release. When a neighbor offered to buy another client's old lawnmower if she was looking for a bit of extra cash, she could recall the promise of money coming and sell it with the sense that the transaction had been foretold. Or when a third client heard his wife say, "This is a decision that has to be made," he could remember the same words being said by Maura Sargent over a spread of tarot cards and then leap decisively to action. But the imprecise nature of the fortune stole some of their power. The predictions could be dismissed as coincidences, hunches. They were a chuckle in the Walmart parking lot when you ran into an old friend as promised. A shiver when the number 17 appeared on an electric bill. A realization that even if you had discovered the future, it really didn't change how you lived in the present. They were truth, but they weren't all of the truth. "I should tell you," Maura always advised her new clients, "that this reading will be accurate, but not specific." It was easier that way. But this was not what Blue was told. Again and again, she had her fingers spread wide, her palm examined, her cards plucked from velvet-edged decks and spread across the fuzz of a family friend's living room carpet. Thumbs were pressed to the mystical, invisible third eye that was said to lie between everyone's eyebrows. Runes were cast, and dreams interpreted, tea leaves scrutinized, and seances conducted. All the women came to the same conclusion, blunt and inexplicably specific. What they all agreed on, in many different clairvoyant languages, was this. If Blue was to kiss her true love, he would die. For a long time, this bothered Blue. The warning was specific, certainly, but in the way of a fairy tale. It didn't say how her true love would die. It didn't say how long after the kiss he would survive. Did it have to be a kiss on the lips? Would a chaste peck on the back of his palm prove as deadly? Until she was 11, Blue was convinced she would silently contract an infectious disease. One press of her lips to her hypothetical soulmate and he too would die in a consumptive battle untreatable by modern medicine. When she was 13, Blue decided that jealousy would kill him instead, an old boyfriend emerging at the moment of that first kiss bearing a handgun and a heart full of hurt. When she turned 15, Blue concluded that her mother's tarot cards were just a pack of playing cards and that the dreams of her mother and the other clairvoyant women were fueled by mixed drinks rather than otherworldly insight, and so the prediction didn't matter. She knew better, though. The predictions that came out of 300 Fox Way were unspecific, but undeniably true. Her mother had dreamt Blue's broken wrist on the first day of school. Her Aunt Jimmy predicted Maura's tax return to within $10. Her older cousin Orla always began to hum her favorite song a few minutes before it came on the radio. No one in the house ever really doubted that Blue was destined to kill her true love with a kiss. It was a threat, however, that had been around for so long that it had lost its force. Picturing 6-year-old Blue in love was such a far-off thing as to be imaginary. And by 16, Blue had decided she would never fall in love, so it didn't matter. But that belief changed when her mother's half-sister Neve came to their little town of Henrietta. Neve had gotten famous for doing loudly what Blue's mother did quietly. Mora's readings were done in her front room, mostly for residents of Henrietta and the valley around it. Neve, on the other hand, did her readings on television at 5 o'clock in the morning. She had a website featuring old, soft focus photographs of her staring unerringly at the viewer. 4 books on the supernatural bore her name on the cover. Blue had never met Neve, so she knew more about her half-aunt from a cursory web search than from personal experience. Blue wasn't sure why Neve was coming to visit, but she knew her imminent arrival spurred a legion of whispered conversations between Mora and her 2 best friends, Persephone and Calla, the sort of conversations that trailed off into sipping coffee and tapping pens on the table when Blue entered the room. But Blue wasn't particularly concerned about Neve's arrival. What was one more woman in a house filled to the brim with them? Neve finally appeared on a spring evening when the already long shadows of the mountains to the west seemed even longer than usual. When Blue opened the door for her, she thought for a moment that Neve was an unfamiliar old woman, but then her eyes grew used to the stretched crimson light coming through the trees, and she saw that Neve was barely older than her mother, which was not very old at all. Outside in the distance, hounds were crying. Blue was familiar enough with their voices. Each fall, the Aglenby Hunt Club rode out with horses and foxhounds nearly every weekend. Blue knew what their frantic howls meant at that moment. They were on the chase. "You're Mora's daughter," Neve said, and before Blue could answer, she added, "This is the year you'll fall in love." 1. It was freezing in the churchyard even before the dead arrived. Every year, Blue and her mother, Mora, had come to the same place, and every year it was chilly. But this year, without Mora here with her, it felt colder. It was April 24th, St. Mark's Eve. For most people, St. Mark's Day came and went without note. It wasn't a school holiday. No presents were exchanged. There were no costumes or festivals. There were no St. Mark's Day sales, no St. Mark's Day cards in the store racks. No special television programs that aired only once a year. No one marked April 25th on their calendar. In fact, most of the living were unaware that St. Mark even had a day named in his honor. But the dead remembered. As Blue sat shivering on the stone wall, she reasoned that at least, at the very least, it wasn't raining this year. Every St. Mark's Eve, this was where Mara and Blue drove, an isolated church so old that its name had been forgotten. The ruin was cupped in the densely wooded hills outside of Henrietta, still several miles from the mountains proper. Only the exterior walls remained. The roof and floors had long ago collapsed inside. What hadn't rotted away was hidden under hungry vines and rancid-smelling saplings. The church was surrounded by a stone wall, broken only by a lich gate just large enough for a coffin and its bearers. A stubborn path that seemed impervious to weeds led through to the old church door. "Ah," hissed Neve, plump but strangely elegant, as she sat beside Blue on the wall. Blue was struck again, as she had been struck the first time she'd met Neve, by her oddly lovely hands. Chubby wrists led to soft, childlike palms and slender fingers with oval nails. "Ah," Neve murmured again, "tonight is a night." She said it like this, "tonight is a night." And when she did, Blue felt her skin creep a little. Blue had sat watch with her mother for the past 10 St. Mark's Eves, but tonight felt different. Tonight was a night. This year, for the first time and for reasons Blue didn't understand, Mora sent Neve to do the church watch in her place. Her mother had asked Blue if she would go along as usual, but it wasn't really a question. Blue had always gone. She would go this time. It was not as if she had made plans for St. Mark's Eve, but she had to be asked. Maura had decided sometime before Blue's birth that it was barbaric to order children about, and so Blue had grown up surrounded by imperative question marks. Blue opened and closed her chilly fists. The top edges of her fingerless gloves were fraying. She'd done a bad job knitting them last year, but they had a certain trashy chic to them. If she hadn't been so vain, Blue could have worn the boring but functional gloves she'd been given for Christmas, but she was vain. So instead, she had her fraying fingerless gloves, infinitely cooler, though also colder, and no one to see them but Neve and the dead. April days in Henrietta were quite often fair, tender things, coaxing sleeping trees to bud and love-mad ladybugs to beat against window panes. But not tonight. It felt like winter. Blue glanced at her watch. A few minutes until 11. The old legends recommended the church watch be kept at midnight, but the dead kept poor time, especially when there wasn't a moon. Unlike Blue, who didn't tend toward patience, Neve was a regal statue on the old church wall, hands folded, ankles crossed beneath a long wool skirt. Blue, huddled, shorter and thinner, was a restless, sightless gargoyle. It wasn't a night for her ordinary eyes. It was a night for seers and psychics, witches and mediums. In other words, the rest of her family. Out of the silence, Neve asked, "Do you hear anything?" Her eyes glittered in the black. "No," Blue answered, "because she didn't." Then she wondered if Neve had asked because Neve did. Neve was looking at her with the same gaze that she wore in all of her photos on the website. The deliberately unnerving, otherworldly stare that lasted several more seconds than was comfortable. A few days after Neve had arrived, Blue had been distressed enough to mention it to Maura. They had both been crammed into the single bathroom, Blue getting ready for school, Maura for work. Blue trying to clip all of the various bits of her dark hair back into a vestigial ponytail had asked, "Does she have to stare like that?" In the shower, her mother drew patterns in the steamed glass door. She had paused to laugh, a flash of her skin visible through the long intersecting line she had drawn. "Oh, that's just Neve's trademark." Blue thought there were probably better things to be known for. In the churchyard, Neve said enigmatically, "There is a lot to hear." The thing was, there wasn't. In the summer, the foothills were alive with insects buzzing, mockingbirds whistling back and forth, ravens yelling at cars. But it was too cool tonight for anything to be awake yet. "I don't hear things like that," Blue said, a little surprised Neve wasn't already aware. In Blue's intensely clairvoyant family, she was a fluke, an outsider to the vibrant conversation her mother and aunts and cousins held with a world hidden to most people. The only thing that was special about her was something that she herself couldn't experience. "I hear as much of the conversation as the telephone. I just make things louder for everyone else." Neve still hadn't looked away. "So that's why Maura was so eager for you to come along. Does she have you at all her readings as well?" Blue shuddered at the thought. A fair number of the clients who entered 300 Fox Way were miserable women hoping Maura would see love and money in their future. The idea of being trapped in the house with that all day was excruciating. Blue knew it had to be very tempting for her mother to have Blue present, making her psychic powers stronger. When she was younger, she'd never appreciated how little Maura called on her to join in a reading. But now that Blue understood how well she honed other people's talents, she was impressed at Maura's restraint. "Not unless it's a very important one," she replied. Neve's gaze had edged over the subtle line between discomforting and creepy. She said, "It's something to be proud of, you know. To make someone else's psychic gift stronger is a rare and valuable thing." "Oh, pshaw," Blue said, but not cruelly. She meant to be funny. She'd had 16 years to get used to the idea that she wasn't privy to the supernatural. She didn't want Neve to think she was experiencing an identity crisis over it. She tugged a string on her glove. "And you have plenty of time to grow into your own intuitive talents, Neve added. Her gaze seemed hungry. Blue didn't reply. She wasn't interested in telling other people's futures. She was interested in going out and finding her own. Neve finally dropped her eyes. Tracing an idle finger through the dirt on the stones between them, she said, I passed by a school on the way into town. Aglenby Academy. Is that where you go? Blue's eyes widened with humor, but of course Neve, an outsider, couldn't know. Still, surely she could have guessed from the massive stone great hall and the parking lot full of cars that spoke German that it wasn't the sort of school that they could afford.
It's an all-boys school. For politician sons and oil baron sons and for...
Blue struggled to think of who else might be rich enough to send their kids to Aglenby.
The sons of mistresses living off hush money.
Neve raised an eyebrow without looking up.
No, really, they're awful,
Blue said. April was a bad time for the Aglenby boys. As it warmed up, the convertibles appeared, bearing boys in shorts so tacky that only the rich would dare to wear them. During the school week, they all wore the Aglenby uniform, khaki pants and a V-neck sweater with a raven emblem. It was an easy way to identify the advancing army. Raven boys. Blue continued. They think they're better than us and that we're all falling all over ourselves for them and they drink themselves senseless every weekend and spray paint the Henrietta exit sign. Aglenby Academy was the number one reason Blue had developed her two rules. One, stay away from boys because they were trouble. And two, stay away from Aglenby boys because they were bastards.
You seem like a very sensible teen,
Neve said, which annoyed Blue because she already knew she was a very sensible teen. When you had as little money as the sergeants did, sensibility in all matters was ingrained young. In the ambient light from the nearly full moon, Blue caught sight of what Neve had drawn in the dirt. She asked, What is that?
Mom drew that.
Did she? Neve asked. They studied the pattern. It was three curving, intersecting lines making a long sort of triangle.
Did she say what it was?
She was drawing it on the shower door. I didn't ask.
I dreamt it, Neve said, in a flat voice that sent an unpleasant shudder along the back of Blue's neck. I wanted to see what it looked like drawn out.
She rubbed her palm through the pattern, then abruptly held up a beautiful hand. She said, I think they're coming. This was why Blue and Neve were here. Every year, Mora sat on the wall, knees pulled up to her chin, staring at nothing, and recited names to Blue. To Blue, the churchyard remained empty, but to Mora, it was full of the dead. Not the currently dead, but the spirits of those who would die in the next 12 months. For Blue, it had always been like hearing one half of a conversation. Sometimes her mother would recognize the spirits, but often she would have to lean forward to ask them their names. Mora had once explained that if Blue wasn't there, she couldn't convince them to answer her. The dead couldn't see Mora without Blue's presence. Blue never grew tired of feeling particularly needed, but sometimes she wished needed felt less like a synonym for useful. The church watch was critical for one of Mara's most unusual services. So long as clients lived in the area, she guaranteed to let them know if they or a local loved one was bound to die in the next 12 months. Who wouldn't pay for that? Well, the true answer was most of the world, as most people didn't believe in psychics.
Can you see anything?
Blue asked. She gave her numb hands a bracing rub before snatching up a notebook and pen from the wall. Neve was very still.
Something just touched my hair.
Again, a shiver thrilled up Blue's arms.
One of them?
In a husky voice, Neve said, The future dead have to follow the corpse road through the gate. This is probably another spirit called by your energy. I didn't realize what an effect you would have. Mora had never mentioned other dead people being attracted by Blue. Perhaps she hadn't wanted to scare her, or maybe Mora just hadn't seen them. Maybe she was as blind to these other spirits as Blue was. Blue became uncomfortably aware of the slightest breeze touching her face, lifting Neve's curly hair. Invisible, orderly spirits of not yet truly dead people were one thing. Ghosts that weren't compelled to stay on the path were another.
Are they?
Blue started.
Who are you?
Robert Newman, Neve interrupted.
What's your name?
Ruth Vert.
What's your name?
Francis Powell.
Scratching quickly to catch up, Blue printed the names phonetically as Neve solicited them. Every so often she lifted her eyes to the path, trying to glimpse something. But as always, there was only the overgrown crabgrass, the barely visible oak trees, the black mouth of the church accepting invisible spirits. Nothing to hear. Nothing to see. No evidence of the dead except for their names written in the notebook in her hand. Maybe Neve was right. Maybe Blue was having a bit of an identity crisis. Some days it did seem a little unfair that all of the wonder and power that surrounded her family was passed to Blue in the form of paperwork. At least I can still be a part of it, Blue thought grimly. All that she felt about is included as a seeing-eye dog. She held the notebook up to her face, close, 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 so she could read it in the darkness. It was like a roster of names popular 70 and 80 years before. Dorothy, Ralph, Clarence, Esther, Herbert, Melvin. A lot of the same last names, too. The valley was dominated by several old families that were large, if not powerful. Somewhere outside of Blue's thoughts, Neve's tone became more emphatic.
"What's your name?" she asked.
"Excuse me, what is your name?" Her consternated expression looked wrong on her face. Out of habit, Blue followed Neve's gaze to the center of the courtyard, and she saw someone. Blue's heart hammered like a fist to her breastbone. On the other side of the heartbeat, he was still there. Where there should have been nothing, there was a person.
"I see him," Blue said.
"Neve, I see him." Blue had always imagined the procession of spirits to be an orderly thing, but this spirit wandered, hesitant. It was a young man in slacks and a sweater, hair rumpled. He was not quite transparent, but he wasn't quite there either. His figure was as murky as dirty water, his face indistinct. There was no identifying feature to him apart from his youth. He was so young. That was the hardest part to get used to. As Blue watched, he paused and put his fingers to the side of his nose and his temple. It was such a strangely living gesture that Blue felt a little sick. Then he stumbled forward as if jostled from behind.
"Get his name," Neve hissed. "He won't answer me and I need to get the others."
"Me?" Blue replied, but she slid off the wall. Her heart was still ramming inside her rib cage. She asked, feeling a little foolish, "What's your name?" He didn't seem to hear her. Without a twitch of acknowledgement, he began to move again, slow and bewildered, toward the church door. "Is this how we make our way to death?" Blue wondered. "A stumbling fade-out instead of a self-aware finale?" As Neve began again to call out questions to the others, Blue made her way toward the wanderer. "Who are you?" she called from a safe distance as he dropped his forehead into his hands. His form had no outline at all, she saw now, and his face was truly featureless. There was nothing about him really that made him human-shaped, but still she saw a boy. There was something telling her mind what he was, even if it wasn't telling her eyes. There was no thrill in seeing him as she had thought there would be. All she could think was, "He will be dead within a year. How did Maura bear it?" Blue stole closer. She was close enough to touch him as he began to walk again, but still he made no sign of seeing her. This near to him, her hands were freezing. Her heart was freezing. Invisible spirits with no warmth of their own sucked at her energy, pulling goosebumps up her arms. The young man stood on the threshold of the church, and Blue knew, just knew, that if he stepped into the church, she would lose the chance to get his name.
"Please," Blue said, softer than before.
She reached out a hand and touched the very edge of his not-there sweater. Cold flooded through her like dread. She tried to steady herself with what she'd always been told.
Spirits drew all their energy from their surroundings. All she was feeling was him using her to stay visible, but it still felt a lot like dread. She asked, "Will you tell me your name?" He faced her, and she realized with shock that he wore an Aglenby sweater. "Gansey," he said. Though his voice was quiet, it wasn't a whisper. It was a real voice spoken from someplace almost too far away to hear. Blue couldn't stop staring at his mussed hair, the suggestion of staring eyes, the raven on his sweater. His shoulders were soaked, she saw, and the rest of his clothing rain-spattered from a storm that hadn't happened yet. This close, she could smell something minty that she wasn't sure was unique to him or unique to spirits. He was so real. When it finally happened, when she finally saw him, it didn't feel like magic at all. It felt like looking into the grave and seeing it look back at her. "Is that all?" she whispered. Gansey closed his eyes. "That's all there is." He fell to his knees, a soundless gesture for a boy with no real body. One hand splayed in the dirt, fingers pressed to the ground. Blue saw the blackness of the church more clearly than the curved shape of his shoulder. "Neve," Blue said. "Neve, he's dying." Neve had come to stand just behind her. She replied, "Not yet." Gansey was nearly gone now, fading into the church, or the church fading into him. Blue's voice was breathier than she would have liked. Why can I see him?" Neve glanced over her shoulder, either because there were more spirits coming or because there weren't. Blue couldn't tell. By the time she looked back, Gansey had vanished entirely. Already Blue felt warmth returning to her skin, but something behind her lungs felt icy. A dangerous sucking sadness seemed to be opening up inside her. Grief or regret. "There are only two reasons a non-seer would see a spirit on St. Mark's Eve, Blue. Either you're his true love," Neve said, "or you killed him."
2. "It's me," said Gansey. He turned around so that he was facing his car. The Camaro's bright orange hood was up, more as a symbol of defeat than for any practical use. Adam, friend of cars everywhere, might have been able to determine what was wrong with it this time, but Gansey certainly couldn't. He'd managed to roll to a stop about 4 feet off the interstate, and now the car's fat tires sat off-kilter on top of lumpy tufts of valley grass. A semi-truck roared by without pause. The Camaro rocked in its wake. On the other end of the phone, his roommate Ronan Lynch replied, "You missed World Hist. I thought you were dead in a ditch." Gansey flipped his wrist around to examine his watch. He had missed a lot more than world history. It was 11 o'clock, and already the chilliness of last night seemed improbable. A gnat was stuck in the perspiration on his skin next to the watch band. He flicked it off. Gansey had camped once when he was younger. It had involved tents, sleeping bags, an idling Range Rover parked nearby for when he and his father lost interest. As an experience, it had not been anything like last night. He asked, "Did you get notes for me?" "No," Ronan replied. "I thought you were dead in a ditch." Gansey blew grit off his lips and readjusted the phone against his cheek. He would have gotten notes for Ronan. "The pig stopped. Come get me." A sedan slowed as it passed, the occupant staring out the window. Gansey was not an unpleasant-looking boy, and the Camaro was not too hard on the eyes either, but this attention had less to do with comeliness and more to do with the novelty of an Aglenby boy broken down by the side of the road in an impudently orange car. Gansey was well aware that there was nothing little Henrietta Virginia preferred over seeing humiliating things happen to Aglenby boys, unless it was seeing humiliating things happen to their families. Ronan said, "Come on, man." "It's not like you're going to class. You know what? It'll be lunch break anyway." Then he added perfunctory, "Please." Ronan was silent for a long moment. He was good at silence. He knew it made people uncomfortable. But Gansey was immune from long exposure. He leaned into the car to see if he had any food in the glove box while he waited for Ronan to speak. Next to an EpiPen, there was a stick of beef jerky, but the jerky had expired 2 years ago. Possibly it had been there when he'd bought the car. "Where are you?" Ronan asked finally. next to the Henrietta sign on 64. Bring me a burger and a few gallons of gas.
The car had not run out of gas, but it couldn't hurt.
Ronan's voice was acidic.
Gansey.
Bring Adam, too.
Ronan hung up. Gansey stripped off his sweater and threw it in the back of the Camaro. The tiny back of the car was a cluttered marriage of everyday things. A chemistry textbook, a Frappuccino-stained notebook, a half-zipped CD binder with naked discs slithering out across the seat, and the supplies he'd acquired during his 18 months in Henrietta. Rumpled maps, computer printouts, ever-present journal, flashlight, willow stick. When Gansey plucked a digital recorder out of the mess, a pizza receipt, one large deep dish, half sausage, half avocado, fluttered to the seat, joining a half dozen receipts identical except for the date. All night, he'd sat outside the monstrously modern Church of the Holy Redeemer, recorder running, ear straining, waiting for something. The atmosphere had been less than magical. Possibly not the best place to try to make contact with the future dead, but Gansey had maintained high hopes for the power of St. Mark's Eve. It wasn't that he'd expected to see the dead. All of the sources said that church watchers had to possess the second sight, and Gansey barely possessed first sight before he put his contacts in. He just hoped for something, and that was what he had gotten. He just wasn't quite sure what that something was yet. The digital recorder in hand, Gansey settled himself against the rear tire to wait, letting the car shield him from the buffeting of passing vehicles. On the other side of the guardrail, a greening field stretched out and down to the trees. Beyond it all rose the mysterious blue crest of the mountains. On the dusty toe of his shoe, Gansey drew the arcing shape of the promised supernatural energy line that had led him here. As the mountain breeze rushed over his ears, it sounded like a hushed shout, not a whisper, but a loud cry from almost too far away to hear. The thing was, Henrietta looked like a place where magic could happen. The valley seemed to whisper secrets. It was easier to believe that they wouldn't give themselves up to Gansey rather than that they didn't exist at all. Please just tell me where you are. His heart hurt with the wanting of it, the hurt no less painful for being difficult to explain. Ronan Lynch's shark-nosed BMW pulled in behind the Camaro, its normally glossy charcoal paint dusted green with pollen. Gansey felt the bass of the stereo in his feet a moment before he made out the tune. When he stood up, Ronan was just opening his door. In the passenger seat was Adam Parrish, the third member of the foursome that made up Gansey's closest friends. The knot of Adam's tie was neat above the collar of his sweater. One slender hand pressed Ronan's thin cell phone tightly to his ear. Through the open car door, Adam and Gansey exchanged the briefest of looks. Adam's knitted eyebrows asked, "Did you find anything?" And Gansey's widened eyes replied, "You tell me." Adam, frowning now, spun the volume knob down on the stereo and said something into the phone. Ronan slammed the car door. He slammed everything before heading to the trunk. He said, "My dick brother wants us to meet him at Nino's tonight, with Ashley." "Is that who's on the phone?" Gansey asked. "What's Ashley?"
Ronan hefted a gas can from the trunk, making little effort to keep the greasy container from contacting his clothing. Like Gansey, he wore the Aglin B uniform, but as always, he managed to make it look as disreputable as possible. His tie was knotted with a method best described as contempt, and his shirt tails were ragged beneath the bottom of his sweater. His smile was thin and sharp. If his BMW was shark-like, it had learned how from him.
"Declan's latest. We're meant to look pretty for her."
Gansey resented having to play nicely with Ronan's older brother, a senior at Aglinby, but he understood why they had to. Freedom in the Lynch family was a complicated thing, and at the moment, Declan held the keys to it. Ronan traded the fuel can for the digital recorder. "He wants to do it tonight because he knows I have class." The fuel tank lid for the Camaro was located behind the spring-loaded license plate, and Ronan watched silently as Gansey simultaneously wrestled with the lid, the gas can, and the license plate.
"You could have done this," Gansey told him, "since you don't care about crapping up your shirt." Unsympathetic, Ronan scratched at an old brown scab beneath the 5 knotted leather bands he wore around his wrist. Last week, he and Adam had taken turns dragging each other on a moving dolly behind the BMW, and they both still had the marks to show it. "Ask me if I found something," Gansey said. Sighing, Ronan twitched the recorder toward Gansey. "Did you find anything?" Ronan didn't sound very interested, but that was part of the Ronan Lynch brand. It was impossible to tell how deep his disinterest truly was. Fuel was leaching slowly into Gansey's expensive chinos, the second pair he'd ruined in a month. It wasn't that he meant to be careless, as Adam told him again and again. Things cost money, Gansey. It was just that he never seemed to realize the consequences of his actions until too late. "Something. I recorded about 4 hours of audio, and there's something, but I don't know what it means." He gestured to the recorder. "Give it a whirl." Turning to stare out over the interstate, Ronan pressed play. For a moment, there was merely silence, broken only by icy-sounding shrills of crickets. Then Gansey's voice. "Gansey," it said. There was a long pause. Gansey rubbed a finger slowly along the pocked chrome of the Camaro's bumper. It was still strange to hear himself on the recording with no memory of saying the words. Then, as if from very far away, a female voice, the words hard to make out. "Is that all?" Ronan's eyes darted to Gansey, wary. Gansey lifted his finger. "Wait." Murmured voices, quieter than before, hissed from the recorder. Nothing clear about them except the cadence, questions, and answers. And then his disembodied voice spoke out of the recorder again. "That's all there is." Ronan cast a glance back over to Gansey beside the car, doing what Gansey thought of as his smoker breath. Long inhale through flared nostrils, slow exhale through parted lips. Ronan did not smoke. He preferred his habits with hangovers. He stopped the recorder and said, "You're dripping gas on your pants, geezer. Aren't you going to ask me what was happening when I recorded that?" Ronan didn't ask. He just kept looking at Gansey, which was the same thing. "Nothing was happening. That's what. I was staring at a parking lot full of bugs that shouldn't be alive when it's this cold overnight, and there was nothing." Gansey hadn't really been sure if he'd pick up anything in the parking lot, even if he was in the right place. According to the lay hunters he'd spoken to, the ley line sometimes transmitted voices across its length, throwing sounds hundreds of miles and dozens of years from when they'd first been heard. A sort of audio haunting, an unpredictable radio transmission where nearly anything on the ley line could be a receiver, a recorder, a stereo, a pair of well-tuned human ears. Lacking any psychic ability, Gansey had brought the recorder, as the noises were often only audible when played back. The strange thing in all this was not the other voices on the player. The strange thing was Gansey's voice. Gansey was quite certain he was not a spirit. "I didn't say anything, Ronan, all night long. I didn't say anything. So what's my voice doing on the recorder?" "How did you know it was there?" "I was listening to what I'd recorded while I was driving back. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And then my voice. Then the pig stopped."
"Coincidence?" Ronan asked. "I think not."
It was meant to be sarcastic. Gansey had said, "I don't believe in coincidences," so often that he no longer needed to. Gansey asked, "Well, what do you think?"
"Holy grail, finally," Ronan replied, too sarcastic to be any use at all. But the fact was this. Gansey had spent the last 4 years working with the thinnest scraps of evidence possible, and the barely heard voice was all the encouragement he needed. His 18 months in Henrietta had used some of the sketchiest scraps of all as he searched for a ley line, a perfectly straight supernatural energy path that connected spiritual places, and the elusive tomb he hoped lay along its path. This was just an occupational hazard of looking for an invisible energy line. It was, well, invisible. And possibly hypothetical, but Gansey refused to consider that notion. In 17 years of life, he'd already found dozens of things people hadn't known could be found,
and he fully intended to add the ley line, the tomb, and the tomb's royal occupant to that list of items. A museum curator in New Mexico had once told Gansey, "Son, you have an uncanny knack for discovering oddities." An astonished Roman historian commented, "You look under rocks no one else thinks to pick up, Slick." And a very old British professor had said, "The world turns out its pockets for you, boy." The key, Gansey found, was that you had to believe that they existed. You had to realize they were part of something bigger. Some secrets only gave themselves up to those who'd proven themselves worthy. The way Gansey saw it was this. If you had a special knack for finding things, it meant you owed the world to look. "Hey, is that Welk?" Ronan asked. A car had slowed considerably as it passed them, affording them a glimpse of its overly curious driver. Gansey had to agree that the driver did look a lot like their resentful Latin teacher, an Aglinby alumnus by the unfortunate name of Barrington Welk. Gansey, owing to his official title of Richard Dick Campbell Gansey III, was fairly immune to posh names, but even he had to admit there wasn't much forgivable about Barrington Welk. "Hey, don't stop and help or anything," Ronan snapped after the car. "Hey, Runt, what went down with Declan?" This last part was directed at Adam as he climbed out of the BMW with Ronan's phone still in hand. He offered it to Ronan, who shook his head disdainfully. Ronan despised all phones, including his own. Adam said, "He's coming by at 5 tonight." Unlike Ronan, Adam's Aglinby sweater was second-hand, but he'd taken great care to be certain it was impeccable. He was slim and tall, with dusty hair unevenly cropped above a fine-boned, tanned face. He was a sepia photograph. "Joy," Gansey replied. "You'll be there, right?" "Am I invited?" Adam could be peculiarly polite. When he was uncertain about something, his southern accent always made an appearance, and it was in evidence now. Adam never needed an invitation. He and Ronan must have fought. Unsurprising. If it had a social security number, Ronan had fought with it. "Don't be stupid," Gansey replied, and graciously accepted the grease-splotched fast food bag that Adam offered. "Thanks." "Ronan got it," Adam said. In matters of money, he was quick to assign credit or blame. Gansey looked to Ronan, who lounged against the Camaro, absently biting one of the leather straps on his wrist. Gansey said, "Tell me there's no sauce on this burger." Dropping the strap from his teeth, Ronan scoffed, "Please." "No pickle either," Adam said, crouching behind the car. He'd not only brought two small containers of fuel additive, but also a rag to place between the gas can and his khakis. He made the entire process look commonplace. Adam tried so hard to hide his roots, but they came out in the smallest of gestures. Now, Gansey grinned, the warmth of discovery starting to course through him. "So, pop quiz, Mr. Parrish. Three things that appear in the vicinity of ley lines." "Black dogs," Adam said indulgently. "Demonic presences." "Camaros," Ronan inserted. Gansey continued as if he hadn't spoken. "And ghosts." "Ronan, cue up the evidence, if you would." The three of them stood there in the late morning sun as Adam screwed the fuel tank lid back on and Ronan rewound the player. Yards and yards away over the mountains, a red-tailed hawk screamed thinly. Ronan pressed play again, and they listened to Gansey say his name into thin air. Adam frowned, distantly, listening, the warm day reddening his cheeks. It could have been any one of the mornings in the last year and a half. Ronan and Adam would make up by the end of the day. His teachers would forgive him for missing class. Then he and Adam and Ronan and Noah would go out for pizza, four against Declan. Adam said, "Try the car, Gansey." Leaving the door hanging open, Gansey crashed onto the driver's seat. In the background, Ronan played the recording again. For some reason from this distance, the sound of the voices made the hair on his arm stand slowly. Something inside him said that this unconscious speech meant the start of something different, although he didn't know what yet. "Come on, pig," snarled Ronan. Someone laid on their horn as they blew by on the highway. Gansey turned the key. The engine turned over once, paused for the briefest of moments, and then roared to deafening life. The Camaro lived to fight another day. The radio was even working, playing the Stevie Nicks song that always sounded to Gansey like it was about a one-winged dove. He tried one of the French fries they'd brought him. They were cold. Adam leaned into the car. "We'll follow you back to the school. It'll get you back, but it's not done yet," he said. "There's still something wrong with it."
"Great," Gansey replied loudly to be heard over the engine.
In the background, the BMW pumped out a nearly inaudible bass line as Ronan dissolved what was left of his heart in electronic loops.
"So, suggestions?"
Reaching into his pocket, Adam retrieved a piece of paper and offered it to him. "What's this?" Gansey studied Adam's erratic handwriting. His letters always looked like they were running from something.
"A number for a psychic?"
"If you didn't find anything last night, this was going to be next. Now you have something to ask them about."
Gansey considered. Psychics tended to tell him he had money coming his way and that he was destined for great things. The first one he knew was always true, and the second one he was afraid might be. But maybe with this new clue, with a new psychic, they'd have something else to say.
"Okay," he agreed. "So what am I asking them?"
Adam handed him the digital recorder. He knocked the top of the Camaro once, twice, pensive.
"That seems obvious," he answered. "We find out who you were talking to."
3. Mornings at 300 Fox Way were fearful, jumbled things. Elbows insides and lines for the bathroom and people snapping over tea bags placed into cups that already had tea bags in them. There was school for Blue and work for some of the more productive or less intuitive ants. Toast got burned, cereal went soggy, the refrigerator door hung open and expectant for minutes at a time. Keys jingled as carpools were hastily decided. Partway through breakfast, the phone would begin to ring and Maura would say, "That's the universe calling for you on line 2, Orla," or something like that, and Jimmy or Orla or one of the other aunts or half-aunts or friends would fight over who had to pick it up on the upstairs phone. 2 years ago, Blue's cousin Orla had decided that a call-in psychic line would be a lucrative addition, and after some brief skirmishes with Maura about public image, Orla won. Winning involved Orla waiting until Maura was at a conference over a weekend to secretively set up the line, and it was not so much a sore spot as the memory of a sore spot. Calls started coming in around 7 a.m., and some days a dollar a minute felt more worth it than others. Mornings were a sport, one that Blue liked to think she was getting better at. But the day after the church watch, Blue didn't have to worry about battling for the bathroom or trying to make a bag lunch while Orla dropped toast butter side down. When she woke up, her normally morning bright room had the breath-held dimness of afternoon. In the next room over, Orla was talking to either her boyfriend or to one of the psychic hotline callers. With Orla, it was difficult to tell the difference between the two sorts of calls. Both of them left Blue thinking she ought to shower afterward. Blue took over the bathroom uncontested, where she gave most of her attention to her hair. Her dark hair was cut in a bob, long enough to plausibly pull back, but short enough that it required an assembly of clips to do so successfully. The end result was a spiky, uneven ponytail populated by escaped chunks and mismatched clips. It looked eccentric and unkempt. Blue had worked hard to get it that way.
"Mom," she said as she jumped down the crooked stairs. Maura was at the kitchen counter making a mess of some kind of loose tea. It smelled appalling. Her mother didn't turn around. On the counter on either side of her were green, oceanic drifts of loose herbs.
"You don't have to run everywhere."
"You do," Blue retorted. "Why didn't you wake me up for school?"
"I did," Maura said, "twice." Then to herself, "Damn it."
From the table, Neve's mild voice said,
"Do you need my help with that, Maura?"
She sat at the table with a cup of tea, looking plump and angelic as always, no sign of having lost any sleep the night before. Neve stared at Blue, who tried to avoid eye contact.
"I'm perfectly capable of making a damn meditation tea, thank you," Maura said. To Blue, she added, "I told the school you had the flu. I emphasized that you were vomiting. Remember to look peaked tomorrow."
Blue pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes. She'd never missed class the day after the church watch. Been sleepy, perhaps, but never wasted like last night. "Was it because I saw him?" she asked Neve, lowering her hands. She wished that she couldn't remember the boy so clearly, or rather the idea of him, his hand sprawled on the ground. She wished she could unsee it. "Is that why I slept so long?"
"It's because you let 15 spirits walk through your body while you chatted with a dead boy," Mora replied tersely before Neve could speak. "From what I've heard, anyway."
"Christ, is this what these leaves are supposed to smell like?"
Blue turned to Neve, who continued to sip her tea with a sanguine air.
"Is that true? Is it because spirits walk through me?"
"You did let them draw energy from you," Neve replied. "You have quite a lot, but not that much."
Blue had two immediate thoughts about this. One was, "I have quite a lot of energy," and the other was, "I think I am annoyed." It was not as if she had intentionally allowed the spirits to draw power from her.
"You should teach her to protect herself," Neve told Mora.
"I have taught her some things. I'm not an entirely wretched mother," Mora said, handing Blue a cup of tea.
Blue said, "I'm not trying this. It smells awful." She retrieved a cup of yogurt from the fridge. Then, in solidarity with her mother, she told Neve, "I've never had to protect myself at the church watch before."
Neve mused. "That's surprising. You amplify energy fields so much. I'm surprised they don't find you even here."
"Oh, stop," Mora said, sounding irritable. "There is nothing frightening about dead people."
Blue was still seeing Gansey's ghostly posture, defeated and bewildered. She said, "Mom, the church watch spirits, can you ever prevent their deaths by warning them?"
The phone rang then. It shrilled twice and kept going, which meant Orla was still on the line with the other caller.
"Damn Orla," Mora said, though Orla wasn't around to hear it.
"I'll get it," Neve said.
"Oh, but..." Mora didn't finish what she was going to say. Blue wondered if she was thinking that Neve normally worked for a lot more than a dollar a minute.
"I know what you're thinking," her mother said after Neve had left the kitchen. "Most of them die from heart attacks and cancer and other things that just can't be helped. That boy is going to die."
Blue was beginning to feel a phantom of the sensation she'd felt before, that strange grief.
"I don't think an Aglenby boy will die from a heart attack. Why do you bother telling your clients?"
"So they can get their things in order and do everything they want to do before they die." Her mother turned then, fixing Blue with a very knowing gaze. She looked as impressive as someone could look when standing barefoot in jeans, holding a mug of tea reeking of rotting soil.
"I'm not going to stop you from trying to warn him, Blue. But you need to know he's not going to believe you, even if you find him. And it's probably not going to save him, even if he knows. You might keep him from doing something stupid, or you might just ruin the last few months of his life."
"You're a Pollyanna," Blue snapped, but she knew Mora was right, at least about the first part. Most everyone who met her thought her mother did parlor tricks for a living. What did Blue think she would do? Track down an Aglenby student, tap on the window of his Land Rover or Lexus, and warn him to have his brakes checked and life insurance policy updated?
"I probably can't stop you from meeting him anyway," Mora said. "I mean, if Neve is right about why you saw him, you're fated to meet him."
"Fate," Blue replied, glowering at her mother, "is a very weighty word to throw around before breakfast."
"Everyone else," said Mora, "had breakfast a very long time ago."
The stairs creaked as Neve returned.
"Wrong number," she said in her affectless way. "Do you get many?"
"We're one number off from a gentleman escort company," Mora replied.
"Ah," Neve said. "That explains it. Blue," she added as she settled back down at the table again, "if you'd like, I can try to see what killed him."
This got both Mora's and Blue's attention in a hurry. "Yes," Blue said. Mora started to reply, then merely pressed her lips back together.
Neve asked, "Do we have any grape juice?"
Puzzled, Blue went to the fridge and held up a jug questioningly.
"Cran grape?" "That will work fine."
Mora, her face still complicated, reached into the cupboard and drew out a dark blue salad bowl. She set it in front of Neve, not gently.
I won't be responsible for anything that you see, Mora said. Blue asked, What? What is that supposed to mean? Neither of them answered. With a soft smile on her soft face, Neve poured the juice into the bowl until it reached the edge. Mora turned off the light switch. The outside suddenly seemed vivid in comparison to the dim kitchen. The April bright trees pressed against the windows of the breakfast area, green leaf upon glass, and Blue was suddenly very aware of being surrounded by trees, of having a sense of being in the middle of a still wood. If you are going to watch, please be quiet, Neve remarked, looking at no one in particular. Blue jerked out a chair and sat. Mora leaned on the counter and crossed her arms. It was rare to see Mora upset but not doing something about it. Neve asked, What was his name again? He only said, Gansey. She felt self-conscious saying his name. Somehow the idea that she would have a hand in his life or his death made his nominal existence in this kitchen her responsibility. That's enough. Neve leaned over the bowl, her lips moving, her dark reflection moving slowly in the bowl. Blue kept thinking of what her mother had said. I won't be responsible for anything that you see. It made this thing that they did seem bigger than it usually felt, further away from a trick of nature and closer to a religion. Finally, Neve murmured. Though Blue couldn't hear any particular meaning in the wordless sound, Mora looked abruptly triumphant. Well, Neve said, this is a thing. She said it like, this is a thing, and Blue already knew how that turned out. What did you see? Blue asked. How did he die? Neve didn't take her eyes off Mora. She was asking a question somehow at the same time that she answered, I saw him, and then he disappeared into absolutely nothing. Mora flipped her hands. Blue knew the gesture well. Her mother had used it to end many an argument after she delivered a winning line. Only this time the winning line had been delivered by a bowl of cran grape juice, and Blue had no idea what it meant. Neve said, One moment he was there, and the next he didn't exist. It happens, Mora said, here in Henrietta. There is some place, or places, that I can't see. Other times, I see. And here she didn't look at Blue in such a way that Blue noticed that her mother was trying hard not to look at her. Things I wouldn't expect. Now Blue was recalling the countless times her mother had insisted that they stay in Henrietta even as it became more expensive to live here, even when opportunities to go to other towns opened up. Blue had once intercepted a set of emails on her mother's computer. One of Mora's male clients had ardently begged Mora to bring Blue and whatever else you cannot live without to his row house in Baltimore. In the reply, Mora had sternly informed him that this was not a possibility for many reasons, chief of which that she would not leave Henrietta and least of which that she didn't know if he was an axe murderer. He had emailed back only a sad face smiley. Blue always wondered what became of him. I would like to know what you saw, Blue said. What is nothing? Neve said, I was following the boy we saw last night to his death. I felt it was close chronologically, but then he disappeared into some place I couldn't see. I don't know how to explain it. I thought it was me. It's not, Mora said. When she saw that Blue was still curious, she explained, It's like when there's no picture on the television, but you can tell it's still on. That's what it looks like. I've never seen someone go into it before, though. Well, he went into it. Neve pushed the bowl away from her. You said that's not all. What else will that show me? Mora said, channels that don't show up on basic cable. Neve tapped her beautiful fingers on the table just once, and then she said, You didn't tell me about this before. It didn't seem relevant, Mora replied. A place where young men can disappear seems quite relevant. Your daughter's skill also seems quite relevant. Neve leveled her eternal gaze on Mora, who pushed off the counter and turned away. I have work this afternoon, Blue said finally when she realized that the conversation had perished.
The reflection of the leaves outside rippled slowly in the bowl, a forest still, but darkly.
"Are you really going to work in that?" Mora asked. Blue looked at her clothing. It involved a few thin layering shirts, including one she had altered using a method called shredding. "What's wrong with it?"
Mora shrugged. "Nothing. I always wanted an eccentric daughter. I just never realized how well my evil plans were working.
How late do you work?"
7. Well, probably later. Chialina is supposed to work until 7:30, but she's been saying all week that her brother got her tickets for evening and if only someone would take over the last half hour.
You could say no.
What's evening? Is that the one where all the girls die with hatchets?
That's the one.
As Blue slurped down her yogurt, she spared a quick glance at Neve, who was still frowning at the bowl of juice, pushed just out of her reach.
Okay, I'm out.
She pushed back her chair. Mora was quiet in that heavy way that was louder than talking. Blue took her time tossing her yogurt into the trash can and dropping her spoon into the sink beside her mother. Then she turned to go upstairs for her shoes.
"Blue," Mora said finally, "I don't have to tell you not to kiss anyone, right?"
4. Adam Parrish had been Gansey's friend for 18 months, and he knew that certain things came along with that friendship. Namely, believing in the supernatural, tolerating Gansey's troubled relationship with money, and coexisting with Gansey's other friends. The former two were problematic only when they took time away from Aglenby, and the latter was only problematic when it was Ronan Lynch. Gansey had once told Adam that he was afraid most people didn't know how to handle Ronan. What he meant by this was that he was worried that one day someone would fall on Ronan and cut themselves. Sometimes Adam wondered if Ronan had been like Ronan before the Lynch brothers' father had died, but only Gansey had known him then. Well, Gansey and Declan, but Declan seemed incapable of handling his brother now, which was why he'd been careful to schedule his visit while Ronan was in class. Outside of 1136 Monmouth, Adam waited on the second-story landing with Declan and his girlfriend. Girlfriend, in fluttering white silk, looked a lot like Brianna, or Kaylee, or whoever Declan's last girlfriend had been. They all had blonde, shoulder-length hair and eyebrows that matched Declan's dark leather shoes. Declan, wearing the suit that his senior year political internship required, looked 30. Adam wondered if he would look that official in a suit, or if his childhood would betray him and render him ridiculous.
"Thanks for meeting us," Declan said.
Adam replied, "No problem." Really, the reason he had agreed to walk with Declan's girlfriend from Aglenby had nothing to do with kindness and everything to do with a nagging hunch. Lately, Adam had felt as if someone had been looking in on their search for the ley line. He wasn't quite sure how to put this feeling into concrete terms. It was a stare caught out of the corner of his eye, a set of scuffed footprints in the stairwell that didn't seem to belong to any of the boys, a library clerk telling him an arcane text had been checked out by someone else right after he had returned it. He didn't want to trouble Gansey with it until he was certain, though. Things seemed to weigh heavily enough on Gansey as it was. It wasn't that Adam wondered if Declan was spying on them. Adam knew he was, but he believed that had everything to do with Ronan and nothing to do with the ley line. Still, it wouldn't hurt to do a bit of observation. Currently, girlfriend was glancing around in the furtive way that was more noticeable for its furtiveness. 1136 Monmouth was a hungry-looking brick factory, gutted and black-eyed, growing out of an overgrown lot that took up nearly all of a block. A clue to the building's original identity was painted on the eastern side of the building, Monmouth Manufacturing. But for all their research, neither Gansey nor Adam had been able to figure out precisely what Monmouth had manufactured. Something that had required 25-foot ceilings and wide open spaces. Something that had left moisture stains on the floor and gouges in the brick walls. Something that the world no longer needed. At the top of the second-floor staircase, Declan whispered all this knowledge into girlfriend's ear, and she giggled nervously as if it were a secret. Adam watched the way Declan's lip barely brushed the bottom of girlfriend's earlobe as he spoke to her. He looked away just as Declan glanced up. Adam was very good at watching without being watched.
Only Gansey ever seemed to catch him at it. Girlfriend pointed out the cracked window toward the lot below. Declan followed her gaze to the black, angry curves Gansey and Ronan had left doing donuts. Declan's expression hardened. Even if they were all Gansey's doing, he'd assume it was Ronan. Adam had knocked already, but he knocked again. One long, two short, his signal. "It will be messy," he apologized. This was more for the benefit of Declan's girlfriend than it was for Declan, who knew full well what state the apartment would be in. Adam suspected Declan somehow found the mess charming to outsiders. Declan was calculating, if anything. His goal was Ashley's virtue, and every step of tonight would have been planned with that in mind, even this brief stop at Monmouth Manufacturing. There was still no answer. "Should I call?" Declan asked. Adam tried the knob, which was locked, and then jimmied it with his knee, lifting the door on its hinges a bit. It swung open. Girlfriend made a noise of approval, but the success of the break-in had more to do with the door's failings than Adam's strengths. They stepped into the apartment, and girlfriend tipped her head back, back, back. The high ceiling soared above them, exposed iron beams holding up the roof. Gansey's invented apartment was a dreamer's laboratory. The entire second floor, thousands of square feet, spread out before them. Two of the walls were made up of old windows, dozens of tiny warped panes, except for a few clear ones Gansey had replaced. And the other two walls were covered with maps, the mountains of Virginia, of Wales, of Europe. Marker lines arced across each of them. Across the floor, a telescope peered at the western sky. At its feet lay piles of arcane electronics meant to measure magnetic activity. And everywhere, everywhere there were books. Not the tidy stacks of an intellectual attempting to impress, but the slumping piles of a scholar.